In today's episode,
you can almost choose happiness in the moment or progress in the moment. I don't think that's
a great, I love that.
I don't think it's as binary as that, right? Like, yeah. I think it is, I think the maybe more nuanced version, happiness is peace in motion and peace is happiness at rest.
That's really good.
So I think in that it's possible to be like peaceful while doing the thing that you have chosen to do.
Welcome to another episode of Creator Lab. This is your host, Bilal Zaidi. My guest on today's episode is Eric Jorgensen. He's the author of The Almanac of Naval Ravikant, an incredible book that has taken the famous Silicon Valley entrepreneurs' philosophies and ideas and compiled them into a book that is jam-packed with incredible lessons. Listen in to hear us explore Eric's approach to writing this unique book that was entirely made up of Naval's words, a discussion around the philosophy of wealth and happiness, both Eastern and Western approaches, and the importance of permissionless leverage and ownership. Why desire is a contract you make with yourself to be unhappy, and the difference between freedom to versus freedom from. Let us know what you thought of this on Twitter. I'm at BZady and he's at Eric Jorgensen. We'll get straight into this conversation with Eric right after a brief message from our sponsors. This week's episode is sponsored by AppSumo, the marketplace entrepreneurs trust to buy and sell products that grow small businesses into name brands. There's no better place for tools to help you build and grow your business. Whether you're a content creator, designer, or marketer, they're connected to some of the hottest tech companies, so you don't have to waste time searching for great stuff. AppSumo makes it easy for you to automate and boost your productivity so you can actually focus on your business. Sign up at AppSumo.com or hit the link in the description below. Now let's get straight into the show. Eric, welcome to the show, man. It's good to have you here.
It's good to be here. I'm a longtime fan of the show, so I'm psyched about this, and we've been planning it for a long time. So this is gonna be great.
Man, I'm glad to have you on, man. Well, just to give the background, this is Eric Jorgensen. You're the writer of The Almanac of Naval Ravikant, amazing book that everyone, before we even talk, I'm gonna say everyone should just go and get it right now. You didn't pay me to say that, but I've genuinely really loved reading the book. There's so many highlights and a lot in the book. It's probably my most highlighted Kindle book, actually, because like every few lines I'm like, oh, I gotta save that.
Like, I was talking to the guys at Readwise. I was like, do you know which books are like the most highlighted by percent, and like, can you show me if I rank on that? That it was definitely like a KPI for me for the book.
I could imagine, man. Yeah, so we're gonna get into, you know, a lot of the philosophy of what you learned through that, through curating and writing this book about Naval's kind of writings and interviews and the kind of mega philosophy stuff, but also a little bit about you, around how you kind of came to write this book in the first place. And because it's quite a unique like process, it wasn't just like a traditional thing of, hey, I've got an idea for a book, let me go and pitch it to a publisher and send them a blurb and all that stuff. So I think the way you've done it is just a lot more of a modern way of doing things. And I kind of want to dig into that as well. But yeah, is there anything else I've missed on you, man? Because you're doing a lot of different things.
So are you, man. I mean, it's a blessing and a curse, you know? Like, it's a little bit of trying to use your ADD for good, not evil.
So you've also, because you've got a full-time job too, right?
I did until a couple months ago. So the company that I was working at sold, and I just like didn't opt in for another tour of duty with the acquirer. So I'm kind of like taking the summer to like relax a little, get my life in order, like learn about all the stuff that I haven't been learning about while I've been heads down-ish for the last 10 years. And do a couple of projects that I've been, you know, had kind of on the back burner, and put them on the front and give them some attention and see what happens.
Yeah. You're actually the third person in the last week that said they're doing something like this. And obviously everyone's got a unique situation, but there is a macro trend of people reevaluating their lives, I guess, especially with the last year we've all had. I'm curious, do you think it's actually to do with that, or is it just you at that stage anyway?
I don't know. I think that too, right? I hear that a lot of like friends and people I follow. And I don't know if that's like, just means like a macroeconomic top Like it's a good spot in the cycle and everybody's like, I'm going to quit my job and do whatever I want.
You mean people are selling rock JPEGs for 200 grand on the internet? Is that what you mean?
Yeah. Or they're like, I bought enough ETH in 2016 that I just don't work anymore. Or, you know, or truly if it's just like, you know, the age that we're at and like kind of our friend cohorts are just going through like, I don't know, I've been through my first like decade of work and that's enough for me to kind of like hit a milestone and just reevaluate what I'm doing. And, you know, it's so much different making a career path decision at 30 versus 20. Like you've just seen so much more, right? You're like, oh, I think I actually like want to head in this direction now that I've seen 1,000 different people head in 1,000 different directions. And I only knew of like 10 possible paths from the career fair or whatever, when I was 20 coming out of college and like choosing a job or a direction.
We didn't really plan to talk about this, but since we're talking about it, I think it's worth digging in because I feel like a lot of people I speak to, including listeners of the show, are going through this. And one of the reasons people tell me they listen to the show is because they want to get examples of people in different worlds, understand their paths and understand their options, I guess. And in full transparency, I felt like this for a bit of time as well. So I've been on kind of a 2 and a bit year flexible work situation where I have a kind of consultancy business, which is not 100% full time. It's just what I spend most of my time doing, the two podcasts I do. And then before that I was traveling and stuff as well. And it's just interesting because I've got to the point where I'm like, well, maybe this is just what I'm going to do, you know, versus find a new thing. I don't know. I'm still kind of in two minds about it. But I think it's great to give yourself that room and space just to reevaluate. And like you said, once you've earned a decent amount of money as well, I think money has a part to play. Like when you're 20 years old, you need to build up your savings and everything like that. And once you've got a decent amount where maybe you're not retired, but you're feeling comfortable, there's kind of a switch, right? And you kind of go from, I'm just speaking for myself, from this kind of defensive, I need to make money survive mode to being more proactive and saying, what do I want to spend my time doing? And what do I truly enjoy? So I think that's actually going to lead into all the stuff we're going to talk about today. But yes, it's a really interesting time, man. I think a lot of people are going through these changes.
Yeah, I think it helps a lot to see, to have the physical, like tangible experience of like having wins under your belt too. You know, like even if we had good ideas when we were 20, I just don't know how to separate the good ideas from the bad ideas and know which ones I'm going to be able to tackle and make progress on. And now I just feel like I have a little bit more of that muscle memory of like, and confidence. So like the financial cushion is definitely a piece of it, but there's also like, you know, I fought 100 fights and I know which 20 I've won, and it gives me a lot more confidence that I will pick the right battles in the future. And so I think there's like some parts of that to it. And there's more confidence in doing stuff that's not an obviously like pre-paved path, you know, especially for people like us, I think, right?
Definitely,
like,
man.
Oh, I don't know. Like podcaster wasn't even a job 10 years ago. And now there's like hundreds or thousands of them, right? So part of it is seeing what other people are doing. And part of it is just like, I don't know, put in enough reps now that like, I know that works.
Completely, Dan. Yeah, I love that. So that kind of leads us into the book, because you just mentioned people like us, you said, and I think people listening to this are probably in a similar mode. They're people who are probably curious, entrepreneurial, but also value kind of like life as well, not just like all about money, all about the big win. It's a bit more of a balanced, holistic approach. So I think let's talk a little bit about the book itself, because when I heard about the book, I was like, this is amazing, because Naval is probably our, you know, the philosopher of our generation in our world anyway. You know, if you're interested in business and technology and startup world and, you know, the new innovations coming out of the world, he's probably like the philosopher of our time, I guess. And with that comes people that love him, and there's people that also hate him for that reason too, right? Like any good person. So I'm curious, like, well, first of all, did I do justice to who Naval is? So maybe you can give a bit of background who he is. And then secondly, why did you choose to go down his path to collect his kind of work?
Yeah. So Naval, I mean, that's a good, like, outsider's view, I think to kind of maybe complement that with some of his story. I mean, he's like lived the American dream, right? He was an immigrant to New York from Delhi, I think, in like when he was 9 or 10 years old. And, you know, single parent household, spent like after school, just kind of living at the library and working menial jobs, like on the come up, right? He was obviously like, was and is very smart. So like tested into some good schools and got into Dartmouth and worked his way into the technology world. But even then it was like, I think he had a hard run the first like 30 years, right? He had some early companies, had some early wins, got basically cheated out of like a fortune that he had to fight for after like some of his early companies, and then became an investor. He didn't start AngelList until he was like 30, I think. And even then it grew out of like a blog and an email list and kind of grew. It's been a really like slow growing behemoth, and some good investments, but those take, you know, 10 years or so to kind of like Uber and Twitter and Postmates and I think MySQL and a bunch of other like amazing hundreds of kind of angel investments.
For people who don't know, even know what AngelList is, could we just share what it is as well?
Oh yeah. So AngelList, AngelList is an amazing story. And I won't do like the whole thing here, but it is currently basically a platform for startups. And so they're able to connect with investors, connect with talent, launch products. So AngelList now owns Product Hunt. So you can like launch products there and find early customers. You can go fundraise there. And as an investor, you can come and build like a syndicate. So one deal kind of composite of different investors. You can host a rolling fund. You can invest directly in this like index of startups that AngelList runs. So it is a huge kind of suite of products now and multiple companies. I think CoinList and Republic are both kind of crypto versions of things that like AngelList had already built. And so they're kind of like straddling into that new economy too. It's a very kind of impressive company. It's like, especially with how little money they've raised and how consistently they've kind of added new successful products over time.
Yeah, I love that. Like even you just mentioned the rolling fund. Like if people have listened to the show, you've had me speak to Sean Puri about his rolling fund and a few other people, Pomp and stuff like that. But yeah, just one of the biggest things that I love about AngelList is just the fact that, like the way you described it there, it's a platform for startups. It isn't, you know, if you said that 10 years ago, whenever it started, you probably wouldn't have just said that. It would have been like, it's a place where investors and startup founders can meet, or whatever the first version was, or it's a place where you can find talent or look for a job. And then over time, they've just added all these layers and really beautifully executed. Really good background on that. And just so Naval was the founder of that. Was there any more you wanted to share on the story before we go into the book itself?
Yeah, well, it's interesting that people find their way to him from a bunch of different things, right? So like I've been following him since probably 2009 or 10 when he was blogging this, like creating the Venture Hacks blog and early kind of launching AngelList. So I knew him from like the startup world. There are also people who know him from the stuff that he's talked about on crypto. And there's also people who know about him from just following him on Twitter and seeing the kind of like philosophy and happiness pieces that he shares. So like, he's like this prism and kind of people are drawn in from all these different directions. But he's talked about investing. He's talked about building startups. He's talked about all this different stuff. And a little bit of like a futurist too, right? So he's like looking at new technologies and how they play out and like the game theory of different, like, you know, unpacking like the sovereign individual and all that stuff. So whatever, there's a lot of reasons to be, there's a lot of interesting stuff that he talks about. People kind of come in one door and then like find their way to all the other stuff that's going on in there.
Yeah, it's funny. I think that the moment I realized he had gone really quite mainstream is when he went on Joe Rogan. And because I feel like in our world, you know, he's got a million followers or whatever, and, you know, people will reference him. He's kind of like a cultural part of technology world, basically. But when he went on Joe Rogan, you know, I had heard a lot of those one-liners and stuff before in tweets or, you know, over the years, over interviews. But then I had people send it to me and be like, hey, have you ever seen, have you heard of this guy? And I was like, oh, this is amazing. Like, this is a, to have him with Joe Rogan as well, who's probably the best person to take out a lot of that knowledge in our era, basically, was a really cool thing to see. So
yeah, so I was like halfway through the book when he did that interview too. So I was like,
oh wow,
went back and put a ton of stuff in there and like had to reconfigure three more hours
of content for you.
Yeah.
So let's talk about the book itself, because what is your book about, and what made it different to other books out there?
Yeah, it's a unique book in that, like, I mean, you said at the beginning, like, I wrote The Almanac of Naval Ravikant, but like I didn't write it at all. Like, all I did was, like, there's not an original word in here from me past the author's note, right? I feel like what I did was take all of the puzzle pieces that Naval has created over the last 10 years between podcasts, transcripts, tweets, blog posts that he's written, like anything that I could get my hands on that he had done, became raw material for me. And there's like a million words of raw material, well over, right? And I just like tried to build the book out of the most valuable of those pieces that really translated all of his most evergreen kind of universally applicable ideas into this one book in this new format that'd be accessible and useful for hopefully anybody on the planet. But definitely like an introduction to him and his ideas and the most valuable things that I thought that he had said, and with supporting stories, and just try to create this experience that conveyed all the stuff that he had to people who hadn't been following him for 10 years or, you know, knew how to go search on Twitter for all the most popular tweets. All the stuff that he'd created was so ephemeral and hard to find through podcasts or Twitter or whatever. So I thought there was so much value that was getting created. But books are such a different medium. You know, they're so evergreen, they're so permanent, and they're so accessible, and they're so universal that people know what to do with books and can approach books in a way that they maybe can't glean knowledge out of a podcast or just a Twitter feed.
Completely, man. No, I love it. And I think what's really cool about this story is that it seems like you just kind of said, hey, I'm going to start, you know, organizing some of this stuff. And then I don't know even if you had an idea to do a book straight away, or it just kind of became that. What was the original kind of idea around that?
I mean, it was originally like, maybe I'll just throw together a few transcripts, right? It was kind of a small thing. And then as soon as, like, the way this started was like, I tweeted that idea, right? I was like, maybe I should compile a few of Naval's transcripts. Like, there's a lot of value in here. And Naval retweeted that like little poll I put out, and I woke up to find like 5,000 people had replied to this poll and were like, oh my God, yes, please do this immediately. And Naval had said like, yo, I'm happy to help, like, provide all the resources you need. Like, you're welcome to do it, basically. And I was like, oh, like, okay.
That's so it
was like
amazing.
Instant scope creep, right? I was like, okay, this is like, now I'm going to do the best version of it I possibly can, not like just a quick version. And so I went and did all of the, like, compiled all the stuff, the million words, the 100 resources, the, like, everything. And I started building, like, categorizing everything and parsing it all out. And I ended up with like a 600 page, like, Poor Charlie's Almanac version of the book. That was like the first manuscript. It was like basically organizing everything he'd ever said, which ended up being way too much for like early peer reviews. And they were like, oh, you gotta trim this down. Like, I'm interested in half of this, basically. And so I just took all the stuff that people were interested, that had the most overlap, right? That was the most applicable for the most people. And that's kind of what became the final book.
Well, what I love, I just want to go into that a little bit more, because when I said early on that this was a different sort of process to most books, what I love about this, it kind of takes a lot of the lessons and learnings from the book and other stuff we've learned about in the startup world of, you know, MVP, essentially, like what you put out was an MVP, I guess, where people got a taste and they said, oh, I would love this. And just that validation of 5,000 people responding and him retweeting, that gives you the kick where you say, you've essentially pre-sold it by that point, right? I had Steph Smith on the show as well, if you know her, and she just recently did a book, you know, a digital version of a book, and she just pre-sold it before she wrote the book. And she probably made you know, sold as many copies slash made as much money as a lot of authors do, you know, because she's keeping 100% of the profit, not just 5% or whatever you might get as an author. So yeah, I think that's just worth mentioning, that the kind of lesson there is for people that you don't necessarily have to have done the whole book before you start sharing it with people. You just put something out and you got enough feedback to realize, oh, there's something here. And then the most important thing for me is just the accountability, right? Like the fact that he said, oh yeah, I'll help you out. You have absolutely no excuses now, right?
Yeah. I mean, I knew I had to publish something. And so like, I was like, there was no circumstance in which like I don't publish something. And so now the question is like around quality, basically, like how good can I make it? And how quickly and over what time horizon? So yeah, it definitely like that this project had like built in accountability from the first instant it existed. So that was, it caused some stress, but I think it was like a good thing overall. Right. Cause writing a book is not, you don't decide once to write a book, like just like you just don't decide once to start a podcast, right? Like, you know, you have to choose to keep showing up like every day or every week for a very long period of time to get done. And it's a thousand or a million small decisions, you know, not one big one.
Especially a book, man, because I mean, I think podcast has its own challenges and stuff, but a book is, it's almost like never finished, right? Like you, it's like a deck. If you do it for work, you create a deck and you go in a week later and you're like, oh, let me move this around. Let me change this one word. But a book is that times a thousand, I'm sure. Because there's so many edits you can always make. There's so many different opinions when you share it with other people. So I'm actually curious to go into that a little bit before we go into the philosophical part. It's just the process, because people who listen to the show know I'm quite obsessed with how people actually do things. And, you know, it sounds cool. Like, yeah, I've taken a bunch of transcripts and put it into this book that looks all shiny now. But just could you walk me through that actual process? Like you were transcribing, I'm sure using some sort of tool to transcribe the audio. And then you put it in a Google Doc. I don't know. Like what did that process actually look like?
Yeah. I mean, it was a little, it was probably a little sloppy, like, cause I was figuring out what the process was as I was doing it. Right. And that's always harder than just running the process. The way I started with Twitter, mostly because I thought that would be a good like microcosm of that represented everything else. So I started with this giant spreadsheet of like all tweets that he had ever shared. And then I did a real quick like binary, like one or zero, is this good and evergreen and interesting? Yes or no? And then I took all the yeses and categorized them. And that kind of became the first, those became buckets for putting excerpts from every other type of resource together. And that became like at least my first version of an outline. And a lot of this, I mean, like there's a lot of like two steps forward, one step back. So like, those are not the final categories. Things got like merged and put together and rearranged and reorganized, like kind of iteratively as you get a clearer picture of what's going on. So I think like being willing to, you know, like any sort of project, being willing to scrap your work and go back and like take a red pen to it, is a huge part of the process, and taking whatever time you need to let the dust settle so that you can actually, it's really hard to like write a first draft and then immediately begin editing. At least for me, I don't know. I have to almost like put enough space between me and that first draft so that the editing me can like, is separate from the, hey, I'm proud of myself because I just finished this first draft version of me, right?
Yeah, completely. Well, I think it brings up the old funny quote of write drunk, edit sober or something that. Yeah. And, you know, not literally here, but just I think there's two phases of writing. I haven't written the way you have, but even for me, it's just there's a time where you just need to get it on paper. You need to get it out of your head. And in your case, maybe that was the organizing part, because it, like you said, it wasn't just primarily coming from your head. And then there's the second part, which is, you know, a different part of the brain almost. It's like the rational, organizational part. So I love the way you described that. I wouldn't have thought of to do it like that, just putting it all in a spreadsheet, which is quite funny. And then the ones and zeros, because I've done that for other things, but not tweets like this. And it's pretty, seems like a pretty good way to do it. If you were doing it again, would you do it differently?
I would still start with that. And in fact, I am like working on another book and I'm starting it in the same process. So I think it's a similar maze, but like a little different. So I'll bump into a few less walls and hopefully there'll be like a little less backtracking, cause I at least know what the next step kind of should be. But I'm sure I'll still start with one set of categories that'll end up changing and merging and getting reorganized and, you know, going through like two or three different outlines and sets of like, cause it's so interesting. It's so important to get the right thread of ideas there. And so like when people say, you know, I sat down, I read this thing in like one sitting because I like couldn't put it down. That to me says that I got the right set of ideas in the right order so that each idea begged a question that was then answered by the next section or by the next chapter. And there's a lot like that is a hard thing to do. And just getting, you know, you have all these puzzle pieces and you can't really change them as much as you want, but you can kind of like find good edges for each other and put them together and find the best version of each idea and thread them together so that it's a natural progression of ideas. And so that's really like that and the density, like you said in the beginning, like how many things you highlighted. I think the bar for, you know, we spend like the opportunity cost of reading a book now is like going on Twitter or TikTok or YouTube or something that's like so addictive. Much higher information density and so much more addictive. And so the bar for a book to be information dense and hold your attention and be like full of ideas and applicable insights is just so much higher than it was in the past. And so I think this kind of like world of nonfiction, like, hey, I'm going to take one idea and then come up with a ton of different stories and fill a book to sell this one idea is just like not going to fly anymore. Right.
Clearly.
And so I hope to kind of flip that and just create like these incredibly, incredibly valuable books that are like, you can read this and 5 or 6 hours and get a lifetime worth of value and knowledge out of it. And that's just not what most books written, especially like written by journalists, tend to be.
No, completely, man. No, I love that. And I'm the last question I ask on the process is, nowadays there's all these fancy tools that people use for writing, right? The one that's coming to mind here is Rome Research, though I don't use that. I don't know if you've used Rome, but my understanding of it is you're essentially linking ideas into this big map. So when you're writing stuff, you could like highlight a word and let's say, you know, the way you just did that book, it sounds like it could potentially be useful. Because you'd be able to basically create this map where everything links together and you'll see how things are related. I'm curious, have you ever tried using any of those or do you think that it's just overkill for what you're doing?
I don't know. I'm not, I've like poked at Rome, but I haven't gone all in. And I think it's kind of one of those things, like if you don't go all in, it might not be that valuable. I'm not like a tool junkie. I know a lot of professional authors use Scrivener, which is cool because you can like combine all this stuff. Not knowing what I was getting into and being like definitively an amateur, I just like started working in Google Docs and just kind of kept going. That was what I was familiar with. I knew all the shortcuts. I knew, you know, so that's just kind of what I went with. And that's all the way through. Like my main tools are basically like Google Sheets, Google Docs. I use Otter for transcriptions and like, that was about it. And I mean, I use Google Docs all the way up through like what I shared with my publisher, Scribe Media, which is kind of like they're like a professional publisher for self-publishing. But I basically like just showed up with a Google Doc and was like, can you turn this into a book? And they're like, yes, absolutely. Thank you. So that was pretty much it for the tools.
I think but that's great to hear as well, because probably the best writers I've interviewed or met or even listened to, like the couple that come to mind, Tim Urban was on the show, if you know him from Wait
for Why. Oh yeah, I love Wait for Why.
Yeah, he's incredible. Polina Maranova, she's writes The Profile.
Paul Graham, I think he's just like uses a text editor, right?
I mean, it looks like he put the text editor on his website because that's what the website looks like. But the reason I bring them up is because Tim told me I think he just uses like a bunch of post-it notes, like maybe even on the Mac, you know, mm-hmm. how you get those different notes and he just has them all kind of spread out. There's no like real big science to it. It's just like it works for him and it's just like a messy process that works. And the most important part is doing the actual writing, of course. And I think it's good to hear either way.
Yeah. I think there's no substitute for just like time with the ideas. like, that's kind of my, probably be my biggest takeaway of that is like, there's definitely mistakes I can avoid making the second time around, but there is just some like no shortcut craftsmanship version where you just can't make good connections unless you just spend a lot of time like swimming around and marinating in these ideas. And so like, I'm really careful when I pick, you know, books or projects that I want to work on, that I pick stuff that I'm like delighted to spend time like marinating in, and like, cause that's, you know, that's all there is to it. Like, if you're willing to spend the time with it, you'll come out with something good on the other end.
Yeah, 100%. I think the tools can just be a distraction for procrastination for a lot of people as well. Like, you know, because you're like, oh, I need the perfect system. And I've definitely done this before as well, where, you know, you see a fancy automation YouTube video and I'm like, yeah, I'm going to set this up with Airtable. And every time a guest clicks this, they're going to come straight to my Zoom call. And look, some of those things really help, right? And they can save you a bunch of hours, which is great. But really, what makes, just speaking for myself, what makes the podcast better is me doing more interviews, perfecting the craft as best I can, asking better questions, getting better guests. You know, that's the 80-20 of it. And yeah, if I can save some time, that's useful. But I think sometimes people overemphasize that versus what's really important.
Yeah, I like to add tools as like solutions to problems. You know, but the hard thing is knowing, like doing enough research to have the knowledge of all the tools and the comparisons. So I feel like what I want is like a tool consultant who's like, they know everything about podcasts or book publishing or whatever. And they like watch what you're doing and then say like, oh, okay, this tool is a no-brainer. Use this specific thing. Let me like train you up in this.
And just use, even like create the template or create the automation. Yeah. Maybe show you how to. I definitely agree, because I think, I've had the MakerPad guy on, Ben Tossel, and Tom Osman is kind of a friend through
Tom's,
internet as well.
Yeah, Tom's probably the closest thing that exists to that now.
That's what I was going to say. He's probably like, you tell him any process and he's like, oh, use this. But what you really want is just, hey, Tom, can I pay you to do this? Or someone like you who knows how to do it. So,
yeah, I think, I mean, the closest thing that I found to that is like, it is definitely more expensive, but it's like you end up just hiring like an agency or a person who already knows and are paid for all the tools, and like you're technically paying for time, but you're also paying for the expertise of like knowing and having all the tools in place. So like when I hired, you know, this scribe to do the publishing, like I don't even know what program they use to do the page layout. I just know that they like use the right tool, built the right thing, like 100%. Ran the whole process, right? So you need the tool and the expertise, and unless you're willing to like go cobble all of that together yourself, like just find somebody with all of the whole bundle of knowledge and tool and expertise all together.
Yeah, and this is a bit of a cliche thing by now. Our mutual friend Jack Butcher has done this one on visualized value, but it's like a visual around you're paying $1 for the screw and $99 to know which screw to turn or whatever. And that's exactly this, right? You're paying for the expertise. But yeah, awesome, man. Well, look, that was a great deep dive into how you did it. I haven't actually heard you describe all the ins and outs of that. So that was useful. Why don't we move on to the meat of the conversation, which is around the amazing stuff you've discovered and shared in the book.
Love meat. Let's do it.
Love the meat. So look, let's start off with I'd love to get your take on kind of the 80-20 of this before we go into the details. So if I was saying, from all the reading and the listening you've done of Naval's stuff, which sounds like everything he's ever published, pretty much a million words. If I was saying, what is the 80-20 of Naval's philosophy on wealth and then 80-20 on the way he thinks about happiness, I'm curious if anything comes to mind.
Yeah, I mean, I think, so in one way, like the book is the answer to that question, right? Like the book is the 80-20 of all that stuff. I appreciate the idea that like 80-20 is fractal, right? So like we can do the 80-20 of the 20 and like that'll be this podcast. And then if you want to expand the 20 and go to the next, then we can do that. So I think the things that come to mind the most, or maybe the first things to unpack is like, accountability, specific knowledge. Because if you don't have those, then like you shouldn't proceed to the next gates, basically. So the ideas of like take on accountability, isn't necessarily, I like this because it's not necessarily about taking on risk. It's about taking accountability for the risk that exists and learning to either accept it or minimize it yourself. And specific knowledge is really this practice of like finding the thing that you can do that you are uniquely well-suited to do. It's a unique combination of like your inherent gifts, you know, your DNA, the way you were raised, your interests. So the stuff that you're curious about and your skills. And we can, it may be fun to kind of talk through some examples of this to kind of unpack it for people, but the people who you find have like very, very usually well-paid, but definitely like unique and well-protected careers are the ones who are leaning into the things that they love, that they're interested in, that they're skilled at, to a pretty extreme degree, and like layering those things together. So, one example, like I love Bill Watterson and Calvin and Hobbes. I grew up reading that. I read every strip that exists. I still have every book, like, and the things that you had to be good at to be Bill Watterson are like, one, you had to be an incredible artist. So he could draw incredibly well. He was clearly interested in like some philosophy and a little bit of like the deeper kind of ideas of life. And it goes way deeper than most comics do, right? There's not a lot of that, but he's also like very in tune with the inner child of all of us and like the hilarious kind of like childish humor of like just throwing a water balloon or whatever. So that the mix of all of those things, like he's a good writer. He was incredibly disciplined about keeping his strip high integrity and like not licensing it, not splitting it out and all this different stuff. But having this kind of introspective thing and the artistic skill to create a very, very uniquely good, strip in itself. So like, that's one example of like layering interests and skills and insights all into this like very, very unique career. Right. And like, you could do the same thing for Scott Adams. Very different comic, very different skill set, very different set of interests.
What about yourself? If you were trying to apply this to yourself, because I know you're going through this transition, you're thinking about the next steps potentially. So I'll just read out one of the lines from the book is, specific knowledge is knowledge you cannot be trained for. If society can train you, it can train someone else and replace you. And that's a great summary of kind of that idea. So I'm curious, like, I mean, I'm happy to share as well. And maybe we kind of just brainstorm out loud, but I'm assuming you've thought a little bit about this for yourself. How do you feel that that has manifested in the way you approach work?
Yeah, I mean, the thing that I'm doing now is I'm able to like spend more time doing the stuff that I was excited to sneak into like my nights and weekends, right? So like when I wrote this book, I had a full-time job. So I was like spending nights and weekends.
That's insane, by the way. We should just acknowledge how ridiculous that is.
Yeah, I mean, it was hard work. It also like took 3 years. So that was spread over a long period of time. But that happened because I was excited to do it, right? Like I would have had a hard time like forcing myself into that if I wasn't into it. But basically all of my opt-in like side projects that I have done have been kind of a unique combination of like, I've researched things and wanted to learn them. I've wanted to publish a product that showed what I had learned and help other people learn. And I wanted to connect and have fun with other people who were interested in the same thing. Right. Like those are maybe the three kind of things that tie everything together, whether I was working on like the Evergreen blog or my podcast or this book or my course or whatever, like that is the thread of all of those things. And so I think that's probably like, and then it's what's the stuff that I'm interested in. Right. So I've always been reading about investors and the stories of different businesses and like Naval more kind of like what is going to change than Warren Buffett style, what's going to stay the same. So I love Buffett and Munger and I've learned a lot from them, but I'm more drawn to sketching out and predicting and changing the future than like betting on the status quo, you know, like super over-optimized quantitative way.
I've never thought of it like those two kind of different schools. It's not even different schools. It's just a different perspective almost. One's backward looking, one's forward looking. They're both useful in different ways. And actually one of the things I've got here, and maybe we'll get to that in the second section around happiness, but one of the summary I remember was, for ancient problems, like how to live a healthy life, family, you know, the kind of old ancient philosophical questions we've all had. Even Naval says he thinks that the old stuff is the best for that, right? Like you look at those philosophies and but for looking at like how's the world changing today, you know, like the stuff that Naval's talked about, like using media and code for leverage, right? That didn't exist in the same way back then, right? So that's kind of a distinction there.
Yeah, I think the summary was like the older the problem, the older the solution.
That
right? So like
sounds like you wrote a book on this, man.
People who are like, I think that was especially apt in the happiness section, right? So like people have been like looking internally and trying to solve their own happiness for a very, very long time, right? And a lot of writing and a lot of religion and a lot of contemplation has gone into this for millennia. And so as he was looking for solutions to that problem, he was looking back at, you know, very old, like especially Eastern writings, and finding, you know, like, are those writings that have endured for thousands of years that people still find useful more likely to be helpful than, you know, some happiness research out of Harvard over the last like 10 years? Like, yeah, probably. Like, there's just, you know, you apply the Lindy test and like, maybe we should just pay a little more attention to the old ways.
Yeah, no, do you know what? I just want to expand on that because as someone who kind of grew up quite religious, my family is Pakistani Muslim, so we grew up going to the mosque and our sect of Islam was quite philosophical, right? And we would read the teaching of someone like Imam Ali, who, you know, there's a book called Nahjul Balagha. I don't know if I'm saying it completely right, but I mean, you should check it out. It's like really incredible old school philosophy and like beautifully written stuff, obviously translated from Arabic or whatever. But yeah, that's the stuff I grew up around in my house, and like poetry, right? Like in the Middle East, poetry, the poets were the philosophers, like Rumi and these famous people we've heard of now. And I was talking to someone else I've had on the show, Ryan Beagleman, who started Summit, and he's like a very philosophical guy as well. And I had lunch with him last week and we started talking about this. And essentially the summary is a lot of us become less religious as we get older in our generation. And he kind of gave me a great reminder that you don't have to, let's say you don't believe everything, right? Which happens to a lot of us, but there's so many good things that you've already spent 20 years learning as a kid. And yeah, you can separate the parts that you don't like or you think need modernizing or whatever. And that was a really good reminder for me coming from that background, because I was like, yeah, well, I've already internalized so many of these ancient truths and I've spent the rest of my life trying to find the new stuff. And the way you just describe it there, I'm going to use this forever. Like the backward thinking and the forward thinking, like they both have value in their own ways. So just wanted to mention that as well, man. Did you have anything similar growing up as well?
Well, we didn't grow up like religious at all or going to church much. I grew up very like curious about it, so I wanted to like learn why it existed and read about it. And it was interesting to be I guess given the gift of a broad perspective, right? So like when I approached the idea of religion, I saw like all of them at once. I didn't have to like start in one and then like try to climb out and look at the rest of them. So it's easier maybe for me to like look at and compare and see the breadth of them. But after like seeing everything that like, especially in Silicon Valley or, you know, the Silicon Valley mindset that's spread around the world now, like we're basically a lot of us recompiling like all of the healthy traditions and habits that like religion bundled and taught you within this narrative and set of traditions that were good for you, right? Like I think most of the things that come are, you know, here's when you should be fasting, like fasting is healthy for you. Here's when you should be like practicing gratitude or meditation or in the form of prayer. Here's how you should be like serving your community. Here's how you should be donating to charity. Here's how you should be, you know, studying like how to live a better life. And we are kind of like unbundling and rebundling a lot of that in like this, I don't know, all of us in like studying and self-improvement and trying to like master ourselves are like rediscovering or recompiling a lot of things that religion had figured out and bundled a long, long time ago. And for better or worse, are just going through this challenge of like figuring out which things to choose for ourselves and how to, it's definitely harder in some ways to like put all these pieces together when everyone's doing it individually rather than like a community opting into a shared set of rules and holding each other accountable. Like, I think that's a really interesting distinction.
Well, I think the meditation example is a really good one, right? Because we now have the science of meditation and the research going on at all these prestigious Western universities. But yeah, meditation has been a part of Eastern practices for forever, right? Like, I mean, a lot of Naval's stuff seems like it comes from Buddhism, and the Eastern philosophies anyway. Maybe not the wealth stuff as much, but the happiness part. And of course, like, you know, he's not saying he invented all these things. He's just someone who's read and learned so much and he's resharing his version of it. But I think that's an example of where even myself, I've probably been critical, or I've just said, you know, you become so science-based that you forget like the limitations too. You know, it's like science is incredible, but it doesn't answer every question. And that's why you have philosophy and you have these other things to answer the parts that don't necessarily have a solid answer. They're more of a discussion, you know? So definitely, yeah, it's an interesting nuance there.
Yeah, it's, I don't know if I'll phrase this right, but I'm trying to like recompile in real time. The like, which questions is it better to have an answer to, even if you know it's wrong, versus which questions are you willing to let go unanswered? Like, which of those is more uncomfortable for you? Is going to vary by question and by person. And I don't know, man. We're just like monkeys with too much brain power trying to figure it all out. And it's a little, we bit off a lot by being born human.
Completely. So let's move on to the next one, because I know we've got a lot to cover here, but no, great discussion there, man. I feel like we could do an hour podcast on each of these 30 bullet points I have. So we'll see which ones resonate most. So I think this one, if you're listening to this and you heard the first Jack Butcher episode, we spent a whole hour pretty much going through the famous, you know, seek wealth, not money or status thread on Twitter of Naval that kicked off Jack's kind of visualized value stuff. So maybe, you know, maybe we can skip some of that stuff, but this one is quite key. It's right. Seek wealth, not money or status. Wealth is having assets that earn while you sleep. Money is how we transfer time and wealth. Status is your place in the social hierarchy. Again, I think that one, when I've read that, it just kind of hit me, because it distinguished these different things that often you're just pursuing all of them at once. And as much as we like to pretend like we don't care about status, of course everyone does, including Naval himself. And and the difference between wealth and money is an interesting nuance as well. So I'm curious, given that, is that something that has really shaped the way that you're thinking about things going forward as well?
Yeah, and I have never said this before, but this changed a lot of how I thought about work, right? So like, most people go get a job because they think they need money. And they pursue the first degree, which is like, how do I turn what I have into money? I'm not sure I love the definition of like, wealth is having assets that earn while you sleep, but I do, if you cut out that definition and just pursue assets, like, I now basically think of my work as like, building, buying, and reinvesting in assets that earn money, right? So like, does going to get a job like fit that process or fit that goal? Like, depends on the job, depends on the compensation structure, like maybe, but maybe not. And I think there, like, you see entrepreneurs and investors who are like, I was listening to your interview with Nick Huber, right? Like, I think he gets this, right? And I've interviewed him for the course too. Like, he's working hard, but what he's doing every day is like building a course, building an audience, buying new assets, new self-storage, building new real estate. Like, his tomato work farms, every day is accumulating assets. Yeah, like buying tomato farms. subtweeting people on Twitter. So like starting flame wars. Yeah. His like work every day that he gets up to do is just like build and buy assets. Right. And it, as we were talking about in this theme of like picking your head up kind of for your first time and like looking around at me, like, what do I want my career to be? Like, you don't have to have a job. Like if you can build wealth through buying and accumulating assets, like that's work and that will result in money. But it's
that's a great distinction.
Yeah.
Because I think there's, the more I've ruminated on this one as well, I think there's a lot of people hear this and just think it's binary and they say, oh, if you got a job, you're not working towards this goal. And I think there's a lot of nuance there around, you know, pay is not always financial. You don't always have a job just for money. There's plenty of other things to gain from it. And it, also the idea of wealth, like you said, like earning assets while you, earning money while you sleep, I guess, is that point. I guess the way you described it, it probably resonates more with the way I've approached my career and investing as well, is if I earn money and invest that money into stuff that grows over time and potentially pays me money, whether that's real estate, even crypto right now, I stake a bunch of crypto that gives me percentage returns. So those things, I'm kind of combining the two. And again, that conversation I had with Ryan Beagleman, you know, he had a $50, $60 million exit, right? He sold this company and he went through this big phase around like figuring out his next step. And we specifically talked about that line. And he, what he realized was he was listening to Naval's voice in one part of his head and another person's voice, and it wasn't his voice. Like, and his voice was saying, actually, I don't mind doing work every day if I enjoy doing that.
Yeah.
And I'm sure Naval would agree with that too. But I think the way it's simplified there is it's oversimplified the way people think about something. You're sleeping and money is accumulating in your bank account, right? Like the point is you need to invest if you want to get outside of the rat race of just your income. And this actually brings up one of the passages in the book. This is actually on page 53, if anyone wants to check it out. Ownership versus wage work. If you are paid for rent, if you are paid for renting out your time, even lawyers and doctors, you can make some money, but you're not going to make the money that gives you financial freedom. You're not going to have passive income where a business is earning for you while you are on vacation. And what I'd written in my notes here was really, is that the right goal? You know, for some people it is, but for a lot of people it isn't. And another kind of phrase that's really stuck with me is from episode 2 of the podcast, Scott Harrison, founder of Charity Water, who I ended up working with for a few years. He says, this is an old saying, which is, do not fear work that has no end. And when I heard that, I was like, I don't even fully get it, you know, but the more I got into it and the more I heard him talk about that idea, that felt like the ultimate goal for work in a way, you know. And it doesn't mean, you know, what that basically is saying for someone like him is when you choose to do work that is so meaningful and is beyond just yourself, and it maybe never ends. Like what he's working on is ending the World War crisis, which is not going to end in his lifetime, right? Unfortunately, most probably. It's like 1 in 10 people in the world don't have access to clean water. But that pursuit and that feeling of I'm working every day towards something that I really do care about. And even if that doesn't end, that's okay because the work itself was meaningful enough. So I don't know if that kind of, you know, I'm sure if Naval was here, he would probably agree with that himself, but I'm curious from your understanding of that. Is there anything else to add?
No, I think those are, it's good to connect those ideas. And I don't think, you know, Naval or I would, you know, you don't advocate for like, just retire and sit under a tree and meditate all day or whatever. Like I will always want to keep working, quote unquote. Doesn't mean I'll always have a job, but I'll always be trying to like, create something or teach something or write something or whatever. Like I can't imagine just playing golf all day, right? Like that is not in me. But I think understanding, I'm very grateful that he had the like that builder buy equity in a business chapter, because I think that resolves a lot of the confusion around what we were talking about of like what's money, what's wealth, what's status, of like that gives you a pretty clear target. And I should say also, like, I get, and because I get questions about this, like, there's a lot of ways to accomplish that, right? And one, some of them is going to get a job at a startup where you are granted equity as part of your compensation. One version is just start your own business, start consulting, start freelancing, start whatever. Another is work a very normal job, but have a high savings rate, right? And like put money into a stock market index where you're buying and building equity there. And so there's a lot of opportunities to explore kind of all throughout that spectrum of how can you accumulate equity? How can you build up wealth? Not in service of like sitting on your ass all day, but in service of finding your way towards, you know, the kind of infinite work that resonates with you, whether that's solving the world water crisis or creating art or volunteering or whatever, right? There's a lot of paths forward.
Or working like the same job that you've done forever. Like maybe that ends up being that too. So
yeah, maybe you love being the single most competent employee in the entire DMV. And like that just like brings... Oh, man.
I want to meet that person.
Me too.
Well, no, that definitely makes sense, man. I think there's a lot to unpack there. But for the sake of time, I'll move on to the next one, which is really what your focus has become a lot of, is this idea of leverage. And, you know, again, I'll read this one passage also from page 34, which is fortune requires leverage. Business leverage comes from capital, people, and products with no marginal cost of replication. And in brackets, code and media. So let's talk about this, because I think we're probably two people who have really leaned into this in the work we do. You know, I've got a podcast, and you've got, you know, all the media stuff that you've done, including a book, if you can count that as media, and the podcast and course and stuff. So yeah, talk to me a little bit about why this resonates so much with you and how you kind of have internalized it to move on to your next step.
Yeah, man. I mean, this could officially be an 8-hour podcast because you pulled my string on my favorite topic.
Let's keep it going.
Yeah. So the leverage idea, I think, is, and this holds up in like my kind of conversations with readers, the idea that is maybe the most important, but probably the lowest percentage unpacked in this book. Like when you read the chapter about accountability, you're kind of like, oh, okay, I understand accountability and understand how to apply this idea in my life. I think the leverage chapter is the one that I get the most questions on, that it's kind of like, okay, where can I go read a book about this? Where can I learn more about this? And I feel like what Naval did here for us all was the favor of like labeling and framing this idea and showing us some of the power of it. And what I have kind of done for the last almost year now since this book came out is start to kind of try to define it a little more clearly, add a ton more examples, add case studies, explore careers through the context and framework of these different types of leverage. Because I think this idea is like explanatory in that like we can use it to see why certain things have happened. Like why is our Bezos and Buffett like so wealthy? Why is Joe Rogan so big, right? Like some of these things, plenty of examples, but it's also like predictive in that we can see what's going to happen based on who is using leverage in different ways and how is that likely to continue to compound. And it's also like effective in that we can use it for our own plans, and we can change our plans around using these ideas and get very different outcomes. And I think of leverage as kind of like the art of accomplishing more and increasing your ability to drive an impact.
I was just about to ask to define it. So that's how you define it, is because the way in very simple terms for me, how I think about it, and this is probably not accurate, it's just what are the things that you can use that grow beyond just yourself? And that's why those labels like capital is one, people obviously is one. If you've got even an agency business like I basically have, I don't have full-time employees, but I have like freelancers that I work with and stuff like that. Like that is, there's only one of me, but there's 10 freelancers, right? And that is the oldest form of leverage in business. Like that is what built the pyramids and built the factories of our world. But this idea of no marginal cost of replication, I think, is the newer version of this. And kind of the passage, again, the next page, page 35, you talk about code and media are permissionless leverage. They're the leverage behind the Newly Rich. You can create software and media that works for you while you sleep. And again, bringing the idea from Jack's podcast, where, you know, his whole thing course was built on build once, sell twice. Mm-hmm. And it's that idea, right? And I think the thing is, people think this is so simple, and it is, but to actually, when you actually internalize it and apply it to your work, you change the way you work, right? And you try to find and work on only the things that give you leverage. And by labeling it, like you said, people, the capital, media and code, you can actually think of ways to exponentially grow. This week's episode is brought to you by NordVPN. I've tried a bunch of these services in the past, but I ended up trying NordVPN, and I've been a happy customer for several years now. There's two reasons I use NordVPN. The first is when I travel, I'm often using unsecured airport Wi-Fi. This is where a lot of hackers can get into your unsecured network and compromise what you're doing on your computer. And secondly, when I'm traveling, I want to use my streaming accounts, whether that's Netflix or BBC iPlayer, and with a click of a button, I'm able to change my virtual location. It's only a few dollars a month, so you should definitely check it out. There's a 30-day money-back guarantee. If you don't like it, you'll get a full refund. So go to nordvpn.com/clab, C-L-A-B, or use the code CLAB at checkout to get 73% off your two-year plan. Plus, you'll also get 4 bonus months for free. This is a limited-time offer, so go there and try it out right now. Thanks again for NordVPN for sponsoring CreateLab. Now let's get straight back to the show. Yeah, can you talk a little bit about that phrase, permissionless leverage? What does that mean to you?
Yeah, so the permissionless part is interesting because traditionally in media or in people and capital leverage, like unless you have your own cash, you basically need to go persuade a gatekeeper to lend you the money or buy your equity or whatever. And on the people side, like people need to choose to work for you, or you need to be able to persuade them. And so in that case, you know, there are gatekeepers all around you that can stop you from accessing labor or capital. The permissionless leverage is in code and in media is that that's basically like global meritocracy of the internet, where anybody can grab a laptop, open a GitHub account and like start pushing code or start recording a podcast and start publishing it to YouTube or to Spotify and basically put their hat in the ring of like how much can they produce something good enough to get adoption. And if they can, then all of a sudden, like they're winning and benefiting and growing, and there is no gatekeeper there to say like, oh, you can't access this this arena, you know, in the way that somebody could could choose to not lend you the money or choose to not work for you. And I should say, like, I think on the capital side and on the people side, like there's definitely more nuance to both of those. The classifications we use in the course is there's 4 types of leverage: tools, product, people, and capital. And so I expand those definitions a little bit to kind of show some of the nuance between each of those things.
Could you say that? So just the tools and product part, and then you said people, and what was the fourth one?
Capital.
So those two, I think, are a bit more straightforward. Could you explain a little bit about the product versus tools? Could you give an example of that?
Yeah. Tools are a weak spot for me because I was talking about, like, not a tool junkie, but this is maybe easiest to visualize with a physical example. So imagine like you're alone in the woods and you're a lumberjack and you're trying to chop down like firewood to like keep yourself warm. If you have no tools, you are not going to make a lot of progress. You're like picking up sticks. If you have an axe, all of a sudden you can fell big trees and chop them up and like get ahead. If you had a chainsaw, now all of a sudden you can drop like 10 trees in an hour and you're cruising. If you had a tractor and another guy, so like increasing people leverage to this, like now all of a sudden, like you maybe have a logging business and you're producing not just enough to get like a month of firewood, but enough to sell and earn income and trade for other things. So that's like tools very broadly. It includes stuff like software tools, it includes Zapier, it includes computers and cars and bikes and all kinds of stuff.
And even just historically, primal on us, it's the reason why a weak human being can capture and hunt down wildebeest or whatever
100%.
Any animal in the jungle back in the day, is because we made tools like spears and bow and arrows and swords and all the old school things. Now we have a lot more high tech versions of that. So that makes a lot of sense, obviously, in that scenario. But if you think of just normal work, of course, there's plenty of tools that help and give you leverage. So what about the product part? Because to me, when I think of product, I almost think of tools, but they're not the same thing. So how would you differentiate those?
Yeah, it's a little bit of a tricky definition, because most people think of, when they hear product, think of like a physical product. Product is more, is a product of you. It's a product of your mind.
Got it.
So I think of product as like when you can encapsulate your experience or insight or knowledge or wisdom into something that can then act on your behalf. So the like memorable metaphor I use here is creating a thin digital clone of yourself. So we are right now recording and creating digital clones of ourselves. They're very purpose specific. They will only ever be able to have this conversation, but they will be able to have this conversation for anyone, anywhere in the world at any time. And what another version of this could be encoding an algorithm or setting up an automation in Zapier. So that is me taking a product or set of ideas or insight or experience, putting that into a digital form, creating a product of myself that can then serve tens, thousands, millions of people or millions of instances at any point in the future.
I love that definition. And I think what stood out to me when you said the permissionless leverage was the gatekeeper. That word, when you said it, mm-hmm. it just made sense straight away, because I thought, you know, if you think of the other one, people and capital, again, you can make arguments for media and code. I'll get to that in a second. But yeah, capital, you require someone to give you capital. Doesn't mean you can't do it, but you need to convince a bank, a VC fund, angel investor mm-hmm. to fund your startup. You can argue that now with some of the interesting stuff happening in DeFi and crypto, that is actually an interesting use case or example I haven't really thought about, where mm-hmm. you can actually go in and essentially access capital without speaking to someone, without convincing someone of your pitch, just right. based on a set of rules. But that's for another podcast. but yeah, I don't know if you had anything else to add on that, but I really like that distinction there.
No, I think there's definitely plenty of nuance in all of these, right? Like there's nuance in the people leverage, right? Which I use people instead of labor because it includes things like freelance. It includes things like fans and audience, and they're, you know, uncompensated leverage includes community or friends or agencies that you can hire, right? Like all of those are people leverage. And you can start really small with that too. It's not like, look, you can either, you have enough money to hire somebody or not. You can start with like task-based labor, like Fiverr or Upwork or something like that, and kind of ladder up to increasingly complex or higher margin or higher risk forms of people leverage as you get more confident. So that's something we kind of work through in frameworks in the course. And the same thing applies in capital. So there's definitely like big loans that you have to go to the bank for. But a lot of people fund or use capital as like cash from operations, right? If you have one project that's so like Nick Huber is a good example of this. Like he started a service business, built up a pile of cash, and then used his own cash along with some others. But like he could have built and bought a business or a facility, his self-storage facility, with just cash that he already had on hand. And that's not gatekeepered cash because you already earned it, right?
Yeah. And actually the way you just, when we're talking about leverage in this setting, I haven't even put that two and two together, that the word I use leverage for the most is in like the financial sense, right? Like you log into your stock account and you get an upsell to use leverage. That is literally, you know, basically borrowed money on margin. And that's again, another podcast, but that is literally the leverage of using other people's money or a loan in this case, and getting the upside from something that isn't just yourself. So you get the extra amount. And so, that actually is kind of tied those two ideas together for me. So that makes sense.
Yeah. I should say, I don't mean like strictly financial leverage, and I don't mean leverage as in like to get the upper hand on somebody, right? Like those are two kind of classic definitions of leverage, which is like not what I'm thinking of here. I'm referencing like the simple machine that like will lift 800 pounds with 100 pounds on this side if you have a long enough fulcrum, and you can just you know, it's about doing the work that gets more work done.
100%, man. Yeah, definitely. That makes a lot of sense. So let's move on to the last part here in a second about happiness. But I think the leverage part is really key. And I think so many people I've interviewed have basically articulated to me that that was a huge switch in mindset for them, where they finally internalized what that meant. And the way I've applied it, I definitely don't get it right all the time. But whenever I look at my work, I try to do this every few weeks. I look at the calendar and I say, what are the tasks that are high value? What are the tasks I can share with someone else to help me with? Should I be hiring an editor for the podcast? Should I be getting someone else to be writing this stuff up for me? You know, whatever it is. It's really hard to stay to stick to that, because someone like me, a lot of people, we're kind of perfectionists in one way. And I hate that word, though, because perfectionist normally means I think of someone who just doesn't do anything. I mean, like someone who has got like high standards and wants it done to a good level. And sometimes it is really hard to train someone else to do it at that level. And there's that kind of trade off of saying, well, it's better to have five people doing this at 80 or 90% than just one of me being drowned in this sort of stuff.
Yeah. The thing we sum up the whole course at the very end with the 10 laws of leverage, right? Like the 10 commandments. And if you remember one thing, remember these. And law number five is, I think, the like one I think about for the context that you're talking about, which is do the work only you can do. So it's not about like, what am I willing to hand off? It's like looking at your calendar and saying like, you know, nobody's going to host this podcast for you. Like, I'm Bill Al. Like, there's nobody, you can't outsource this part. Like, no one else can do this for you. We're going to have but everything else on the calendar today, like whether it's editing or writing show notes or whatever else, or sharing, like it really helps you flip that. It like inverts that problem a little bit and helps you trim down to like, okay, there's two things today that literally only I can do, and everything else can either slide or get handed off, or somebody else, I can train somebody else to pick up for me. And it doesn't matter if it's done at 80% or 110%. It just matters that like I'm doing the work only I can do. And I think if you focus, and if anybody focuses on that, it'll be a good guide for, you'll find yourself automatically sort of putting your attention in the right places and compounding leverage like somewhat intuitively.
Definitely. And I'll just add one nuance from the way I think about it, which is this is with the goal in mind of getting the maximum output, or, you know, using your time efficiently or effectively, which I think is a great goal for a lot of people. But where it becomes quite tricky is for creative work specifically. There are some parts of creative work that I just love doing for the sake of doing it, right? Whether that's writing. Honestly, even sometimes when I've done it in the past, video editing is a weird thing where I know I shouldn't be spending time doing it, but I've become that 12-year-old kid in my bedroom teaching myself to use Windows Movie Maker back in the day, right? And it's that feeling of joy you get. So, and again, I think you would agree with this, and I'm sure Naval would too, just around this idea of, you know, one, you need to know why you're doing something. And as long as you're just proactive and understand why, and at least don't just become completely reactive to doing all this stuff, then that is the most important thing. And sometimes the lens that you're using is, do I enjoy this for its own sake? Do I want to play? Like right now, I'm being creative. I want to write something because it's a fun thing for me, or there's another reason for it. And I think sometimes, I know you're a well-rounded person in this way because you've clearly got this creative side too, but I think on the extreme 10 out of 10 person who doesn't have that creative side, they don't have the same feeling towards it. And I think a lot of what I've realized with Creator Lab is that most of the people I'm most interested in have an element of that. And it's about figuring out the elements of play that are most important to you, you know?
Yeah, I don't think you get super good at this kind of stuff without feeling like you want to play with it and be creative with it and do something like unique and new. And, yeah, you got to have a little like a sacrilegious approach to it almost yeah. to like do something unique and new and fun.
Completely, man. So just to wrap this part up now, I mean, one of this one I absolutely loved, which was around the idea of spending a year to decide and a day of acting. And the passage here is, we waste our time with short-term thinking and busy work. Warren Buffett spends a year deciding and a day acting. The act lasts decades. And that is a really interesting idea, right? Because there's another sort of person which is like all action, just keep going, hustle hard, like just, you know, grind it out. And then there's the Warren Buffett approach, which is, I'm going to sit and I'm going to observe and I'm going to make sure I'm going to spend the most time on figuring out what the right thing to do is. In this case, the one with the most leverage, the one with the biggest opportunity. Mm. And I do think it's a bit of a paradox here, because traditionally in the startup world, you don't necessarily always know what that thing is. You get to that through experimentation, and failing fast is another phrase that is often used. So I'm curious on your take on this, because, you know, you could kind of argue either side, and how's that kind of manifested in the way you approach work?
Yeah, I think, there's definitely like a relationship between the size of the action and the amount of consideration that goes into it. Right.
Great point.
So if you're publishing a podcast every week, you can't like plan a podcast for a year and publish one weekly podcast and then like expect that to shock the world. But in the process of publishing a book, like you could say, like you publish a book in one day, but you work on it for 3 years, or you think about it for a long time. And the relationship between those things, when you're allocating as much capital as Warren Buffett does, like that's super, super
slightly
important
thing for
slightly higher stakes. Yeah, slightly higher stakes. And I don't know, all this work kind of exists on a different spectrum. Like the amount of time I spend thinking about a tweet versus thinking about a blog post versus thinking about a book, very, very different. But those that passage, I think, comes near where he talks about some of the other like highly dominating decisions, which is basically like who you're with, where you are, and what you're working on. So when you're thinking about, you know, where to live, where to move, thinking about who to go to a business with, who to choose as your life partner, or what to work on, you know, what company to join. Those are actions that have, when you know an act is going to take decades to unfold or be in effect for decades, don't underthink it.
Definitely. Yeah. I mean, well, that's the thing. A lot of people rush decisions like that, and then they end up just landing in something that they don't necessarily want to do, but then there's a sunk cost, because now you spent 4 more years in this industry or company, then you've got the golden handcuffs of the stock grants, and then you're just like, oh, now I've had a kid, I've got a mortgage, I'm just going to kind of accept it. Which again, look, that is still fine for some people, but it's not necessarily the best way to approach it.
It is so much harder to get to stop things than to start them. And it's so uncomfortable to be undecided, right? Like is anytime, like where I see this in myself is start, like if I have, you know, 10 hours of quote unquote free time for 2 consecutive weeks, like half the time that results in me like launching a new project or company or something. And then a month later, I'm like, you fucking idiot. Like, why did you do this? Like, I am not willing to let this act last decades. And I didn't think about it hard enough, and I didn't like commit to it. And so I think there's like some value in experimentation and trying small things and launching them and see what happens. But there is also like, it is very possible to underthink it and just like let your discomfort with sitting still, like get the better of you. And then you find that you started something that it's hard to get out of, right? Like that's almost like a systems 100%. Law. Yeah.
Yeah. All right. So I'm going to move in. I guess we're kind of getting into the happiness part now, but this one really hit me when I read it, because it was just like such a great zinger. So I'll just read it out here, which is, retirement is when you stop sacrificing today for an imaginary tomorrow. And when today is complete in and of itself, you're retired. But I'll just say that first part again, because I really loved it. Retirement is when you stop sacrificing today for an imaginary tomorrow. And that was interesting, because the word retirement is interesting there, because I'm, you know, I don't know even if retirement is what I would think of in that scenario, but that, honestly, I'll just be honest, from my point of view, I've probably been someone who's always thought about the future, right? And maybe you're the same. And you, especially when you're young, because you've got your whole life ahead of you and you think one day I'm going to do this, and that you've got all these dreams. And then, but the point here is about sacrifice. So it says when you stop sacrificing today. So I'm curious, like, yeah, this is a great passage that I'm sure you've kind of thought a lot about. So was there anything else from your side that why it resonated so much?
I mean, I like how that ties into what we were talking about before, right? Like, just the ability to choose your work is really like what I hear here. You know, if you are, we're all going to be doing something with our day. And if you are doing something meaningful, you know, the word work just doesn't even really apply. And if what you would do with your time is like, I'm curious, like what percent you think you are retired? You know, like if all you want to do is like have a podcast and like run an agency.
Yeah. Honestly, I mean, you asking me, I mean, I'm trying to think now, the word retired, it's just, yeah, I guess the word retired is maybe not the word I think of, but yeah, with that definition, I'd say I'm probably like 50% the way there, but
yeah, like, you know, like 50% not sacrificing today for an imaginary tomorrow.
I'd say recently it's felt a little bit more versus like the last few years has been like 70-80%, where the way I define it anyway is if I look at my calendar in the week, which hopefully is not too much, what were the things I really chose to do myself?
Yeah.
Versus like things I felt obligated to do, or, you know, I needed to do to keep something going, you know, and it doesn't mean I hate those things. It just means it might not be the first thing I wake up and say, I need to do this thing. So for me, it's something I've actually consciously written out when I started this kind of newer chapter for the last few years, was what were the, it's something I've borrowed from Andrew Wilkinson in our conversation around anti-goals, you know, because you can often say what you really want to do in life, but that's sometimes really hard to answer. Whereas it's a lot easier to say the things you really don't want to do. And one of the things I don't like doing is being in meetings where I don't need to be there. Because it just that is the epitome of busy work and not meaningful work, where you know everyone's there just to show their face. And it's not, often not a bad intent, right? It's just that's what happens in companies. And especially being self-employed, most of the time I can choose not to be in those if they're not relevant. But if you say no to all of them, eventually someone's gonna be like, hey, like, are you ever gonna join this again? You know what I mean? So it's kind of a fine balance where, and sometimes I do need to be in them. And so, like, for example, one of the clients I work with, I was going to this weekly meeting, and I just said, like, every week if I'm sharing something, it's not that meaningful. Like, there hasn't been enough change. So why don't I come every 2 weeks? And now every 2 weeks when I go, there's more to share and it's more impactful. People listen more attentively. And so that's a minor tweak. But
I like that, though. That's smart. It's not like, it's not binary. It's not like I'm canceling this meeting. It's like,
how about I think there's a need for it. I need to be sharing some of the things that I've been working on and like how it benefits them. So I think that's completely fine. But it just, it's that feeling of, oh, someone put something on my calendar, you know, like where we didn't, and that's something I'm over-optimizing for, right? I've put that right at the top of my list. And the sacrifice is, it means I might get paid less. You know, I'm not like maximizing my earning potentially in one way, but I'm okay with that because the trade-off is I'm optimizing for something else. Yeah. So when that starts getting out of whack and I say, oh, and now I'm having to deal with that anyway, then I say, well, why don't I go and have a real job and, you know, get paid twice the amount or whatever. So it's just, there's a constant, you know, like sliding scale there. But yeah, what about you? Because, I mean, right now you're obviously literally on a between the job break, but how would you answer that?
Yeah, I think it varies a little bit like week by week. I got a lot of like random family stuff that is definitely like fills my obligation bucket at the moment. But there's like, I don't know. I think that like, I love conversations and I hate meetings, and like, it's a fine line between the two, right? Like
that's a great distinction. Yeah.
I've had an empty calendar and like, that's not bliss either. You know, like I want to do stuff and hang with people and learn things. And like, but I have very few meetings now or things on my calendar that like 10 minutes before I'm like, ugh, shit.
Yeah.
I do not want to click this link. And like, that's the, like the number of like, ugh, per week is like maybe what I need that's to optimize for.
That's a great, that I like that because, you know, there's this, again, slightly cliche, but I forgot who said it. Is it Derek Sivers or something about the hell yes or no?
Mm-hmm.
And again, I think that's a good idea around, you know, if ideally everything in your calendar, you're like, yo, I really want to do this, or any project you're working on. I think that's a good distinction. But just realistically, for most people, you're not going to jump straight to that, right? Like there's a transition. Mm-hmm. And the first step is becoming aware and not just being a robotic person who is just reacting to everything that's being sent to them. And I think this, that feeling of I don't want to be having to go to this, that normally is a chance for you to realize, okay, I need to make a change. Yeah. Including myself, like I might need to do that myself, you know, soon. So it's just I think whereas like honestly this conversation or tomorrow I'm recording with Trung and Jack for Not Investment Advice, I look forward to that every single week.
Hell yeah.
You know what I mean? And I'm like, oh, this is like me hanging out with friends. And like this, is we've never met in person. But if you were in New York or I was in your city, we would meet for lunch or dinner or whatever. And we would sit for 3-4 hours talking about this sort of stuff. So this is fun for me as well.
Yeah, absolutely. I've been looking forward to this for weeks. I was wondering, when did you actually start Creator Lab? What year was it?
Yeah, it was 2015 is when I started recording. And then I
was put it called it out. Creator Lab then?
It was called Creator Lab, but I didn't put it out until 2016. And that's the interesting thing, because the phrase creator now, people think of creator economy, right?
Yeah.
I'm almost annoyed about that because I actually like that world and I count myself as a part of it. And a lot of people I've interviewed are kind of part of it. But the word creator to me was used as someone who creates things, literally, whether that is a business, a nonprofit, artwork, a TV show, a book. Like that was the underlying act that I was trying to dissect, you know. And I love that word, a creator. And I didn't want to say Entrepreneur Lab or Innovator Lab or another lame word like that. And but, you know, that's why it was just a place for me to have conversations with people from all sorts of walks of life. And I guess you were probably thinking that was the word.
No, I was like, then. This has been around for a long time. And I was kind of like, did you like accidentally coin creator thing?
You had it here first. No, I think that when I started it, because I was working at Google and YouTube back then, a lot of people at work thought of a YouTube creator. Right. So they would say, oh, is it anything related to that? And even then I kind of thought, oh, that word has some connotation to it. But, you know, you kind of just got to run with it. I really love the name, but it's just, you can't always be completely on the nose either. So that's how it landed now.
That's what you get for being so early. I hope you bought some domains. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. All right, man. So look, this one was really funny to me. That Buddha was a prince. And this was kind of the question here for a lot of people ask is, why is there a whole section on being wealthy, right? And the kind of rebuttal to that is what Naval wrote here, or you wrote, let's get you rich first. I'm very practical about it because, you know, Buddha was a prince. He started off really rich and then he got to go off into the woods. And I thought that was quite a funny one because, first of all, it's a hilarious visual of a Buddha running into the woods. I actually did an interview for someone else's podcast a few days ago. And we've known each other for like 10, 15 years. We grew up in the same place in East London. We both kind of came from working to middle class backgrounds. And he's kind of gone down a very like social justice route, which is awesome. And he's doing this kind of like... in that world, and mine is a very different path, but we both care about the same things. We care about helping ourselves and other people improve their lives, you know, whatever that is. My one is really about like ownership of yourself and you know, ownership of your actions where as much as you can. And I think a lot of people in that world will say, or people in the business world are way too obsessed with money, or you know, maybe that's not the right goal. And the richer people I've spoken to, like billionaires, you know, you know that's the truth, right? Like, money is not everything, of course. Mm-hmm. But there is a level of comfort, I think, that really is needed. And depending on where you live and the way you live, that is a different amount. And it's often less than you think. But I think when you're not comfortable, when you're worried about paying your rent every month and you're tied to a job that you hate or you don't especially love, essentially you don't have the freedom to choose yourself, right? Mm-hmm. That is the part which I think is really important. So, yeah, I mean, was there anything else from your side on that idea of Buddha running into the woods?
No, I mean, I remember coming across that for the first time and being like, oh shit, like I didn't know that. But I think it's interesting, and I appreciate the practicality of it, right? Because the number of times I've been told by rich people, like, oh, money doesn't matter, doesn't solve all your problems, and you're just like, fucking easy for you to say, man. Like,
exactly. Yeah.
And so I think it's like, I had this debate with Chris Williamson, I think, on his podcast. And for some people, it's easier to get rid of the desire for material things and basically like go become a monk and, or join a commune or whatever, and just like eliminate your desires. And that's the extreme version of that path. But like, that's one path. And the other path is, for some people, it is easier to achieve basically the most reasonable desires and then like, and then turn your attention to kind of like inner work. And that's like, I guess what Naval allows here is like, there's no right path. Like, eventually you have to get your desires, the denominator appropriate of like your desires and your actuality. And you can tweak both of those variables, and taking ownership of both of them is important. And if you just get on that hedonic treadmill and never get off, you're not any better off. But for some people, it is going to be just easier and more practical to achieve some level of material success and wealth, and then kind of turn to the inner work. And that's what he did. So that's what he's showing us how to do. I'm sure it's not the best for everybody. But like, for some people, and I think I'm in that camp, like I don't know if I would have been able to shake the desire for that, whether it like just based on how I was raised and what I believe. And, you know, like a middle-class capitalist American, like guy who's been reading about business my whole life. And I did deeply believe that like almost every transaction results in consumer surplus that makes both parties better off. And so like, I'm just never going to not be interested in that and believe that that's probably better for everybody. And like admire entrepreneurship and think that that's the way to bring innovation and life improvements to more and more and more people. So not everybody has that worldview, and that's fine. And like, maybe they're on the monk path. That's cool. But there's very few books that are about wealth and happiness together and the relationship yeah. between them. And so that's where I think that this is like, for people that sense tensions in it or don't understand how to like the relationship between the two, I was in that camp. Like, I think this is a very helpful set of ideas to kind of show what that relationship is like.
I'm curious, when you think of your own kind of path, when do you know there's enough and that you've hit that point where you say, okay, I'm comfortable enough to, you know, the way he puts it, let's get you rich first, right?
Yeah.
You know, because obviously that's completely relative. And, you know, so for yourself, though, how have you applied that to the way you think about your situation?
Yeah, I mean, he also says, like, it's a fallacy to believe there's some number where it just turns off. And I totally agree with that. I mean, I think it's kind of like what we've been talking about. Like, there's a relationship between, you know, the amount of obligations you do and the amount of like assets that you have, like building wealth on your behalf, and the amount of attention that you can put towards things that you really find resonance with and appreciate, whether that's, you know, quote unquote work that like gets more stuff done or continues to accumulate assets or investments, or whether that's just spending more time with your family or producing art, and whether or not that art earns you anything or not. Like, you know, it's not a, at least I know in my life, like I will not have like work. Okay. Retirement date. You know, I know that was kind of the old model and a lot of like what our parents did, but like, I think it's just going to be kind of a slow gradient of like, I worked my ass off for 10 years doing things that I was like obligated to do and things that I wanted to do. And I think that mix will just change a little bit based on like what's going on with my family or what's going on at work or what's going on, you know, how different investments do. Like all of that will be kind of in constant flux.
That's a great way to put it. Because I completely agree with you. I don't think there's a magic number either. But I guess the way I was thinking of it is that moment, or what are the things that you're looking out for? So I think you answered it there by saying it's that balance that we discussed earlier, the tension between what are the things I want to do versus not do, where do I still feel the obligation that I need to do something that I don't want to do. And for a long time, you do need to do that, right? Like you need to build up your equity, both financially and knowledge-wise, reputation-wise, whatever. And yeah, so I completely agree with that, man. And I love that, the kind of newer definition there, which is probably, we're two examples of this right now. Like I'm not really thinking of a retirement day either. I'm just saying, why do I want to think of something when I'm 60 years old? Like I just want to live like that now and do the meaningful work now, explore interesting ideas, have a good time along the way. Because I'm not against work. Like I think one of the problems I have with the FIRE community, which I have learned so much from, the financial independence, retire early community. And again, I'm obviously painting with a broad brush and I'm basing it on what I read on Reddit and stuff. I've learned so much about investing and all the stuff there, but it just feels like so many people are sacrificing right now and they're cutting all their costs. They're not doing the things that will bring them joy in the next 10, 20 years to just be able to retire like a few years earlier. So one day they can switch it off. And to me, it's like, well, instead of working 40 or 50 hours a week, what about if you work 20 hours a week and you found work that you found quite interesting or whatever that balance was for you? And that's kind of how, again, not to say I've got it all figured out at all, but I've been a lot closer to that for myself over the last few years than previously. And at the same time, when I had a job, I really liked the job. Like I was more than happy to work 40, 50 hours a week or whatever it was. So I think it's just for people to figure out that balance for themselves.
Who do you read in the FIRE community?
I've read a bunch of different blog stuff, like Mad Faintist. I can't remember Mr. Money Mustache.
Yeah.
But honestly, it's the stuff I've learned the most from is just on Reddit. Mm-hmm. And if you go to the FAQs of the different communities, there's the FIRE Financial Independence one, and then there's Fat FIRE, which I really like. Fat FIRE is like the baller version. So they're like, oh, we're trying to get to X amount and it's much higher. People aren't necessarily sacrificing as much, but also people there are kind of crazy balling out sometimes and you feel kind of like, what the hell am I doing? So there's an element of that. So what about yourself? Is there any others that you like?
I like Mr. Money Mustache a lot. And I think he's a good example of like not everybody in FIRE is like super, super sacrificing. I don't like their attitude towards work is that like every day at work is it sucks and like they're miserable.
Exactly. I'm like, maybe that's the part you need to optimize, not just the number in your head, you know?
Yeah. But I think Mr. Money Mustache does a good job saying like, look, all the stuff that you actually makes you happy is like wholesome and cheap and is like biking to the park and having a picnic and chilling with your friends. So like you do not need, you know, millions of dollars to live well and be happy, right? And like that's kind of a scam. So I appreciate that. I think Financial Samurai is cool, and the White Coat Investor is really good too. It's like specifically for people in the medical profession.
I haven't heard that one.
It's a little bit more technical, maybe, but it's kind of like in that Fat FIRE. It's like you got high. Their unique demographic is they got like high income, but like super super high debt. And they just have this like weird kind of relationship with money that they have like none until they're 30. And then all of a sudden they're like in the top income earners. And like, that's just a recipe for disaster. So that's an interesting, like kind of blog in that area too.
That was a great suggestion. The other one I'd add is Ramit Sethi. I'll Teach You to Be Rich. It sounds like the scammiest book. But I've shared that with a lot of people. I don't always love his style, but I think what he talks about is generally the same sort of stuff. But I like the
fact
that
watch out for his click funnels, man. He'll get you.
Oh my God. Yeah. You get down that funnel, be paying for some course. But no, I think he's really good example. I think he means really well. And I think he's got really valuable information. And the big difference there is essentially, like, he defines it as a rich life. It's not just about money. It's about what is a rich life to you, and having those non-negotiables. And for example, it's a silly example, but for him, it's like he doesn't want to go to a restaurant and have to worry about ordering appetizers, right? And that sounds like a silly little thing, or going to a coffee shop. And that's something that I'm the same, right? Like, I do like being able to make coffee at home for 1/5 of the price, but like sometimes it's not about the price of the coffee. It's the fact you went and you went for a walk. Like in the last year, that was the only fun thing we got to do. We go for a walk, get overpriced coffee and sit outside, and that's completely okay. And I like the idea there of asking the $300,000 questions, not the $5 questions. And, you know, should I have a latte today is a $5 question, but investing more, saving more, and asking for a raise are the $300,000 questions. So, yeah.
And his automation stuff is really good, too. Like making it a no-brainer, paying yourself first, that kind of stuff.
Yeah, yeah. So, yeah, man. Well, yeah, that's definitely an interesting world as well. So, look, man, I know we're going probably over time here. I'm okay to keep going for a little bit if you are, but let me know if you need to cut out.
No, let's do it. I told you eight hours. Let's go for it.
8 hours. All right. We'll just keep going, man. If people still hanging out, this is going to be the happiness part. So I think people are going to like it. One of the things before we really get onto that I really just want to call out was this idea of direction versus speed and the importance of the direction you're going in versus how much force you apply or, you know, how fast you're going. Especially when it comes to leverage. So, you know, could you share a little bit more around that? Like why direction is so much more important than just going at 100 miles an hour?
Yeah. I mean, the mental model, like answer to this, and I'm a big like mental models guy. So I read like Farnham Street and Poor Charlie's Almanac and all that stuff, like constantly. The mental model explanation of this is like velocity versus speed, right? So velocity is like speed with direction, and speed is just like area covered. And so the kind of classic graphic is like one very precise arrow of like moving in a clearly chosen intentional direction versus like drawing this crazy spiral where you're not actually getting anywhere. But you feel like you're moving really fast, and velocity is just more important than speed. Like it is better to put, you know, 5 bricks in the right wall each day than to like lay 50 bricks in some fucking random pattern that you come back the next day and you're like, what did I do? Like I didn't, none of these are part of any long-term plan. So the other kind of piece that fits in here that you asked about is like, how does leverage apply to that? You know, my definition of leverage is like doing the work that gets more work done or doing the work that increases your impact, your ability. And leverage is just going to get you more of what you're already getting, right? So it's a force multiplier. So if you're going bankrupt and you add leverage, like you will go more bankrupt faster. And then it's not your desired outcome, right? So be careful with only applying leverage to things that are working for you and results that you want to get more of, and apply it iteratively and systematically and in low risk kind of intentional ways. But all of that comes with like being methodical and being willing to, like, you know, my crew coach always said, like, slow is smooth and smooth is fast. Like,
oh, that's good.
Make no unnecessary movement, and it's better to move slow and like keep everything stable and balanced, and just like work on efficiency of movement, not speed of movement. And it feels uncomfortably slow, but like slow is smooth and smooth is fast.
That's really good. I'm going to remember that in the gym, you know, like when you're lifting weights or something, and just that feeling of perfecting the form and not being like, I need to lift this crazy weight, and just do it, get it out the way. It's like, just, that's really good. Actually, I'm going to remember that one, dude.
Yeah. I mean, that applies with lifting. I think like the like 4 seconds up, 4 seconds down, like you're better off doing like 5 really slow reps than like banging out 20 really quick, poor form, like lightweight things where you're just slopping all over the place and more likely to hurt yourself, right?
Yeah, completely. Love that one, man. So look, I've got a few more for you here on the happiness side. Let's just jump straight into it. This one kind of really resonated with me because I've heard it discussed in other areas too. So I'd love to kind of jam on it with you. that essentially happiness is not suffering. So he writes, happiness to me is mainly not suffering, not desiring, not thinking too much about the future or the past, really embracing the present moment and the reality of what it is and the way it is. So that second part, being the present moment, I think we've heard a thousand times. This comes from, you know, mindfulness, you know, being in the moment, which I'm not trying to diminish that. It's a really important idea, of course, but I think a lot of people have already heard that. But this idea of happiness to me is mainly not suffering, not desiring, not thinking too much about the future or past. So why do you think the word suffering is so important here? Because another person I've heard talk about this is Jordan Peterson. I don't know if you've heard of much of his stuff, but he comes from like a more of a psychological background and therapy and stuff like that. But I always found it quite like a negative take on life, you know, like life is not suffering. But the older I've gotten and the more I understand the stuff that everyone goes through, including myself, you realize like, yeah, that's kind of what it is. You know, there's so much, there's going to be suffering. There's going to be parents passing away, getting sick, tragedies, trauma, like, and in for some people, much worse stuff than that. So I'm curious, like, yeah, did that surprise you as well when you first read it? Or like, what did you think about it?
I don't know if it's surprised me. I don't know. You read these things and you go through this like quick roller coaster of like, makes sense. Doesn't make sense. Does it make sense? Oh wait, there's a lot in there. Like, oh wait, I got to think about that more. And so you can take a lot of these sentences and really like sit with them for a long time. I think the thing that kind of comes to mind for me on that, and I think it's contextualized around that passage in the book is that like so much of our suffering is self-inflicted, and seeing, you know, where we can identify, we can't choose to like not suffer when we lose a parent or a friend or, experience an accident or something like that. But we do choose a thousand like small sufferings every day when we allow things to be harder on ourselves or put ourselves through things that we don't need to. And I like the suggestion here that basically like we are kinder to ourselves, and we are kinder to ourselves and like allow ourselves to live in the present by intentionally kind of limiting desires and removing the optional suffering, you know, not choosing to be so hard on yourself, and believing that you're doing yourself a favor by being hard on yourself. You know, most people I know, at least in my circle, and probably people who are, you know, listening to stuff like this, are achieve things by being hard on ourselves instead of by letting go and seeing what happens and seeing good things happen. But a lot of times, and I'm trying to see this and let this happen more and more, like seeing what happens when you let go instead of when you push yourself. Like you probably won't do nothing. You will probably do something very authentic and very honest and very, very fresh and like paradoxically, like might actually accomplish a lot more if you're not pushing yourself to accomplish more. Or at least accomplish something more.
When you say
unique.
Let go, if you don't mind me asking, sorry to interject, but when you say let go, what do you mean by that? Do you mean when you're trying to let go of something bad that's happened or move on from something? Is that what you mean? Or
I mean to not operate from a very specific vision that your current or that your past self has. Maybe. Got right. It. Like if you have set a very specific goal for yourself or vision for yourself and not updated based on like what is interesting or comes naturally to you now, like you may be causing some like extreme suffering for yourself.
Just living in the past. Yeah, I get you. You haven't really reinvented it or at least sense checked if it still makes sense the way it did when you.
Yeah. If you're holding on to a desire that your 16-year-old self created for you and trying to live up to it, but you haven't decided, or maybe subconsciously you've decided that your 30-year-old self doesn't desire that anymore, or that there's a more important like desire that you're focused on now, can you let go of that old thing? Or are you still holding on to the suffering attached to that?
That's an interesting idea. So this actually brings up the idea of desire, which is also in the book. So again, on if you read in the book, you want to fast forward to this. It's on page 138. Desire is a contract you make with yourself to be unhappy until you get what you want. This one I thought was absolutely phenomenal, because I'm going to say that again. Desire is a contract you make with yourself to be unhappy until you get what you want. That, like, it's such a short line, but there's like mm-hmm. so many parts in there. Like the contract, the fact, just even calling it a contract with yourself yeah. is already great. And then you're a bit unhappy until you get that thing, and that's such an interesting definition of a desire. So I guess the question that it brings up for me is that always a bad thing? Are all desires bad? Or like, why is the goal to even not have that in the first place? Or is this a harsh definition of what desire really is?
I don't know. I think it's maybe a harsh definition, but I think I think it would do to overcorrect in that direction rather than like the other one. Because I think it is so easy to harbor new desires and to cultivate new ones. Like in 30 seconds on Instagram of scrolling, right? You can be like, oh, I want to go to that place. I want to meet that person. I want to like learn that dance. I want to eat that meal. I want to like buy that company. Like it is so easy to just like let desires like pour into your eyes and ears at all times. And you could, you know, very reasonably wake up and go to bed with 500 more desires for that day. And if that's what you do all day, every day, you're going to be fucking miserable. You would spend so much time desiring that you have no time to accomplish or triage those desires or anything. And I think, you know, no matter what I find it hard to imagine or think, come up with any social media that isn't basically driving increased desires and the like quick, cheap dopamine that comes with seeing something that could be, like seeing these possible futures. Like, I feel like that's what Instagram is selling you most of the time. And that's what products are selling you. And that's what a lot of people are watching on YouTube or Pinterest or whatever. And it just focuses all of your attention on this gap between what is and what could be, but you can't have all of these things. So you can't manifest all 500 of those desires all at once. And so it is not that any one of those desires is like evil or the source of all your suffering. It's that the 499 that aren't the one true thing that you actually want to focus on and get after. And so that's the prescription that Naval makes, or at least the way he says he lives it with his life. He's like, I try to have one desire at a time because that's plenty. That's where I focus. And I just let go of every other desire or fight the instinct to add more desires to my plate, because I know those will make me unhappy. So if he's really trying to start one company or focus on, you know, teaching his son how to ride a bike or something, like just ignore what's going on at work. Like that's maybe a harsh prescription or hard to do for those of us who are trying to juggle a lot of different desires, but recognizing, or at the very minimum recognizing, that that's the source of your unhappiness, and adding new desires is going to more likely to make you unhappy than happy.
Yeah, so really, because I think, like you said, it's better to lean that way than the opposite way, which is I need to go after all these desires. Mm-hmm. I guess the way I'm just thinking out loud here, but I'm thinking about the difference between a desire versus a dream or a goal, you know, that might be mm-hmm. a more positive frame on it. So, let's say I desire to be a healthier person. Obviously, that is a mm-hmm. positive thing that we all agree with. But yeah. I guess the distinction here is the, if you're constantly saying, until I have a six pack, I'm not going to be happy. That is, I think, maybe the distinction. I don't know. Maybe I'm misunderstanding that and mixing up those two ideas of desire versus a dream or a goal or something like that. How would you differentiate between them, or would you differentiate between them?
Well, let's like unpack healthier, right? Like, what does it mean to be healthier? What are all of the desires That's inherent true. In that? Is it to live longer? Is it to look better? Is it to accomplish some physical feat? Is it to just follow a system of steps,
right? That's probably like not that's too broad.
I think that's perfect, right? Like that's it's a great example of like a desire that people have that they don't unpack. It's like, well, there's actually 20 desires enough in there. When I say healthy, I mean, yeah, I want a six pack and I want to climb Kilimanjaro and I want to run a marathon and I want to do a freestanding handstand and I want to go to CrossFit every day. And like, are there actually 50 desires in that one umbrella that you think like, or is there one of those goals that you'd be happy to accomplish and the thing that you would actually want to focus on? But if you're just jumping back and forth between all of them, it was
a bit of a lazy phrase on my point, but you're right. It does demonstrate what we often do. But let's just say, to get more specific about it then, let's say I have a desire to run a marathon.
Okay.
Like that, and you know, a lot of people say you have a goal to run a marathon, mm-hmm. right? And so I don't know even if that's the right phrase, but in this scenario where we're saying to let go of a lot of these desires, but in this case the act is something positive in a way. So in that scenario, do you think I'm just being nitpicky about the word?
No. I think like, you know, we are, this feels like the physical version of the like monk path or the like accomplishment path, right? Like, if your goal is to run a marathon and you make that your main desire and you focus your energy on that and you are making clear progress towards it, like, I think you will find like fulfillment in that and joy in accomplishing it. If you do, if you are trying to like, if you're trying to run a marathon and build a podcast and build a family and like find your soulmate, and like, if you have five desires of equivalent things and you just cannot give each one the attention it deserves each day, that's where you start that's where desire turns into suffering, I think. But it's really easy to, you know, it's the same thing I say when I'm like, when you give me 10 spare hours, like I go start a new company, like,
yeah.
Like that's me just like adding new desires or new, projects or new, like trying to act towards possible other future visions instead of just like staying focused on the one chosen, like focused desire at a time.
Do you find this constant struggle as well? Because this is something I've talked to some other people about and I've struggled with. So there's this thing where maybe let's lose the word desire and goal for a minute, because I agree with what you're saying, but this idea of motivation, right? And this is something I've definitely struggled with. I'm sure many people listening to this have as well. That as you become more in the moment and you become better at living day to day and enjoying the day to day, like I would say right now I'm as happy as I've ever been because I've practiced being happy every day, right?
And
And you know, I've got rid of some things that are toxic or not good for my life or whatever. So that is a big whole thing there, right? But the more comfortable and happy I become day to day, it's a hard struggle to also have those things that drove me in the past, right? Mm-hmm. Whether that was running the marathon or it was starting a company or earning X amount of money, you know, start whatever it was, right? There's many of those big goals. So when I was 18, I wrote out all these crazy things I wanted to do, and then I did some of them, and it's this weird feeling. And to be completely candid, it's happening almost with me kind of right now with like a net worth number, right, in my head, that I've always said, oh, I would love to hit X point. And when I hit that point, I'm kind of almost scared in a way, because I've already felt that sense of being way too comfortable, right? Like, and I don't, there's a fine balance between comfort and not having the stress of the world on you, and especially financial stress, because I grew up where in my household we had overdraft every month, and I know that is not something I ever want, right? And that leaves mental scars, especially I'm sure for my parents more than me. So there's that, right? But that at that age, that drove me to saying, well, I'm going to go and earn lots of money. I'm going to start a company. I started an e-commerce business when I was 16 years old. That came from that negativity or rough time, right? And then when you get to a certain point where you're like, okay, I'm okay, right? I'm at the moment anyway, my health is okay and all these things that I care about are okay. It's a weird balance, right? I don't know if you've had anything similar or you've sensed something. And it's this paradox of I'm happy, so why does it matter? But I also want a bit of that fire, you know what I mean? And I find ways to get that fire again. And like, even this podcast is a great example, right? I've done this for 5-6 years. There's times where I did it every single week. Like the last year, I basically did it every week with only big guests, and it took all my energy, right? And yeah. And now recently I've had to say, okay, this is taking up a disproportionate amount of time and energy that I need to like put it in its place. I still love doing this though, so I want to keep doing it, but I need to find a balance, right? And it's just this constant adjustment. So I'm okay with that, but I'm curious for you, have you felt that as well, where you lose a bit of fire?
Yeah. I mean, I think you're right. It's a paradox, right? And I think Naval like admits that or shares that too, right? Like you can almost choose happiness in the moment or progress in the moment.
I love that.
I don't think it's as binary as that, right? Like, yeah. I think it is. I think the maybe more nuanced version that I think I'm going to get right is like happiness is peace at, or peace is happiness at rest, and happiness is peace in motion. I think I got that right.
Say that again. That was really good.
Happiness is peace in motion, and peace is happiness at rest.
That's really good.
So I think in that it's possible to be like peaceful while doing the thing that you have chosen to do. It's a little different than the like hustler, like hard charger, like wake up and slap yourself and like dive in there, like kind of like alpha athlete thing that like, you know, I think a lot of me and probably a lot of people have had chapters of in their lives. But maybe that's the resolution to the paradox of like, definitely a lot of good things had come from like putting a chip on my shoulder and choosing to be unhappy until I got what I wanted. And that like, I don't think there's anything, you know, there's no right or wrong here, right? Like we are all living our own subjective experience, and you can choose whatever mix of these things that you want. And I think there's maybe some, you know, you see those statistics of like people in their 70s tend to be happier than people in their 20s. And it's maybe because they've internalized some of this, or maybe because they've just lowered their desires and found ways to kind of be peace in motion.
Almost.
Yeah. Yeah. And reconcile that paradox.
So I think it comes down to a lot of expectation as well, right?
Totally.
Like especially when you're young. And again, look, we all want that young energy too, right? Like change the world. The world is at my feet. I can do anything. And you need that. And I think that's really important. But then as you get a bit older, you realize, okay, there are some rules to the game. There are some boundaries, even if you're the sort of person that likes to break boundaries, like I'm sure we are in our own ways. So it's that, like you said, it's a balance. But yeah, it's a constant struggle for me, to be honest.
Yeah, it's a struggle, and that's okay. Like I think it's totally worth saying again, like there's no right or wrong. There's no you should do this or that. Like the only point of this book is to just show you the relationship between those and let you set your own dial wherever you want to set it. You know, if you want to take on 10 things every day and like you're doing 75 hard and starting a podcast and creating all this stuff, like you want to put yourself through hell, like you're going to come out a stronger person and you may have accomplished more than your peers. And like maybe some dude who is just sitting under a tree, like tossing a ball, is going to be happier than you in that moment. But you guys have chosen different paths and that's perfectly okay. Like you got your life to live and he's got his.
I completely agree, man. I think where I've netted out, and it's probably, you know, similar to what you just said there, is I needed to get rid of those desires that were manifested through wounds. You know what I mean? They were from, you know, that's another 2-hour therapy session / podcast, but that is, you know, things that happen to you, things you experience, and some of them are good, but a lot of them aren't good, and they manifest in driving a lot of those actions or motivations and healing a lot of those things. Yeah, it does change you as a person, right? But that's fine. And the closest I've got to it where I feel my best is where I have that peace. I have the feeling of I'm happy in the moment, but I still have something to strive for and something to kind of move forward. And whether that is literally just every day I'm getting slightly healthier, whatever that means to me, whether that's losing weight, building muscle, eating a clean meal every day, or it's doing more, perfecting my craft as an interviewer. Like that's something I I'm definitely not there, but I really take seriously and I try to.
Oh man, I think you're so good. I think you're so good at this. Yeah.
Thanks, man. Yeah, and it's just for me, it's just like, or it's the third thing of just finding ways to just enjoy that day. And did I get to do that? Like recently I've been going for these like 1-2 hour walks in the morning in the park, just on my own, and like listening to stuff, and you know, and that is incredible. But then there is the stuff of, I'm still like a type A person deep down as well. Like I like to see the money in my bank account go up, and I like to see my investments do well. And I like to get a rush when I land a client that is going to make X amount of money, you know? So those are all fine. Like it's just what makes an individual. It's just always constantly reconciling and saying, let me steer it back. Let me not let the ego take over here. Let me not let that 16-year-old wound come up again. And I need to prove something to myself in the room, right?
Like,
I'm sure I still have some of those things, right? But anyway, yeah, so that I think that's the closest I've got to finding that balance.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that's, you know, we're all on our own journey. And I think the people that this may help the most is the ones who have never understood that relationship before, I guess.
That's a great point for sure. Listen, man, we've been going for ages. We're doing a Joe Rogan one today. So I will just finish off on this last one, which I thought was a great way to kind of sum it all up, which is the difference between freedom to versus freedom from. And I'll just read out this little passage. My old definition was freedom to do the things, to do anything I want, freedom to do whatever I feel like, whenever I feel like. Now the freedom I'm looking for is internal freedom, is freedom from reaction, freedom from feeling angry, freedom from being sad, freedom from being forced to do things. I'm looking for freedom from internally and externally, whereas before I was looking for freedom too. And I just thought that was really beautifully kind of summarized. And I'm sure he's talked about that 10 times and you just beautifully summarized it there. I'm curious for you, like, this really resonated with me, but I'm curious for you, like, was this something that really hit home, and why did you choose to include it in this section?
Yeah, I think, it's a good pick for a wrap up, because I think it shows happiness, it shows wealth, and it shows the growth over time. I think like when we're young, we're so governed, at least like in my case, you know, like, you just don't get to do what you want most of the time. Like you're being told and shuttled and pushed and whatever. And so you want this, you have this freedom too. Like that's your association with freedom. And as you become more of an adult, you have more of those responsibilities and more of those desires and more of those obligations. And so freedom from those things, freedom from that like voice of yourself, voice in your own head, or the things imposing themselves upon you. It's as much of an aging thing as like people want to accumulate wealth so that they can have that independence. It's not like access, it's control your own time, right? That's what Munger says. That's what Benjamin Franklin said. That's what Naval said. They're all kind of like saw wealth as that way to control their own time. And I think from this theme, like wealth and happiness both are, you know, he says like, you can get rich and then find out that only solves the money problems. And you still have all of these like internal psychological problems or challenges or things to deal with so that you can, there's another batch of freedoms that come with mastering each of these different levels or different practices or understanding these things.
That's a great way to put it.
Yeah. And if the freedom from, you know, it ties into the FIRE movement. It ties into this like percent retirement. Like it's a good kind of theme of all of these things that we've been talking about. And I hope maybe that it serves people who can realize this younger and start optimizing for things that will make them happier in the long run. Like, you know, learning that at 30 is maybe different than learning it at 50.
Learn from the mistakes of people who spend their whole lives chasing that. You don't need to make the same mistake.
Yeah. Or, you know, chase it to the extent that you feel like you need to, but understand that, you know, when you finish running that race, this is what you might think. And if this is the conclusion that you might reach and we can give you a glimpse of it now, you might adopt it a little sooner. And,
I love it, man.
Yeah.
Listen, dude, we got to do this in person as well. At some point, I'm sure we'll cross paths at some point. So
hell yeah, I'm looking forward to it. Let me know
when you're here. But this has been incredible, man. I mean, we went way over the time, but I think this is we'll probably be about 2 hours when we put it out. But that's a good. I think for a discussion like this, you can't rush it. You need to explore the ideas and let it
marinate. Yeah, we kind of wandered all over the place. Sneak some personal finance in there.
Yeah, that's my favorite type, man. Listen, man, thanks again. Where can people learn more about you and follow you and learn all about the things you're working on?
Yeah, so I'm ejorgensen.com is my like website with all my writing and newsletter and podcast and stuff. You can get the course on there too, the course on leverage. And then I'm on Twitter, like kind of constantly to a fault. So yeah, find me there.
Love it, man. Well, dude, thanks again. Thanks for all that you've done here, man. You've really done an incredible job of simplifying this and summarizing it. And you know, there's going to be lots and lots of people over the years who find this much later down the road. And you've kind of captured a moment in time. I'm looking forward to seeing the next one you're doing, man. And
thanks for squeezing this good juice out of me, man. You're a great, great interviewer, and this was super fun.
Appreciate it, man. Thank you so much. All right, I'll speak to you soon. Cheers.
Later.
Hope you enjoyed the show. Make sure you're subscribed on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or your favorite podcast app. You can also watch all of these visually, plus bonus clips on youtube.com/creatorlabfm. If you enjoyed the show, let me know what you think. You can say hello to me on Twitter. I'm at bzaidi, B-Z-A-I-D-I, or creatorlabfm on any other channel. I really appreciate it. It helps spreading the word with your friends and colleagues. It helps to get this out to more people and allows me to get better guests for you guys. And lastly, if you want access to exclusive content and free giveaways like the recent books that we gave out, make sure you're subscribed to the email list. I'll send out an occasional email with lessons learned from the episode. So if you're interested in that, and of course the free giveaways, who doesn't like those, go to creatorlab.fm/subscribe. Until then, I'll see you on Twitter and speak to you next week.